John chapter 2. As Les mentioned in the prayer, our goal here is to learn more about Jesus. And yet as we've got into the study of the book of John, well, we've talked about Jesus, sure. But the focus hasn't been just on Jesus. There's been a lot of other circumstances as we're getting into the introduction of the book and John the Baptist and who is the writer of the book and all of these different things. But now as we get into chapter 2, for sure, the story is really going to focus more on Jesus. Not to say that it wasn't in chapter 1, but now we're getting into more of the storyline of the life of Jesus, and really stepping right into his ministry is what we find here in chapter 2. And so as we look at the text, and we start opening up the ministry of Jesus, so to speak, it kind of opens up wide open. We're looking at the text, chapter 2, and as it begins, "And the third day there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. And when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, 'They have no wine.' And Jesus said to her, 'Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come.' His mother said to the servants, 'Whatever he says to you, do it.' And there were set there 6 water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. Jesus said to them, 'Fill the water pots with water,' and they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, 'Draw some out now, and take it to the master of the feast.' And he took it. And when the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and did not know it where it came from, but the servants who drew the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom. And he said to them, or said to him, 'Every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when men have well drunk, then that which is inferior, But you have kept the good wine until now. This beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum, he, his mother, his brothers, and his disciples, and they did not stay many days there." Well, it's a story that is familiar to a lot of people, religious or not religious. People know something about Jesus making water to wine. And sometimes different motives for knowing something about what this story is. But we need to kind of dig into it enough to at least kind of understand the context in which some things are said. And what does it mean? What does it teach us? And try just to understand the primary point of this. In fact, I would even ask the question, if I was just to say, what is the primary point of the verses we read right now? What would you say? A miracle. You know, I think sometimes lost in the whole story right there is that this was a miracle that took place. Now, people might have something to say about wine and that Jesus made wine, and there can be a lot of debate that people can come up with as to whether drinking alcoholic beverage is right or wrong. And missed in the whole discussion is the point. Jesus just performed a miracle. And that's something that we need to kind of see and get a hold of right here. On our outline, on the top of the page here, I just want to go over the first couple of paragraphs just to kind of set the story in place here just a little bit. Hey, Daryl, I've got a PowerPoint map. If you could hand this to Lindsay or set this up. I forgot to. PowerPoint just says Gospel of John. Thank you. I think we'll get to that. On the outline here, the Apostle John provides a forceful account of the miraculous power of Jesus. The purpose is to convince men that Jesus is the Son of God. We talked about that some in earlier lessons. And it's really how John, the Apostle John concludes the writing, you know, as well. And many other things Jesus has done, many other miracles that he's done, more than could be written in this book. A second paragraph. The Bible story of the wedding feast in Cana of Galilee tells us the first of many miracles that Jesus performed and gives us a clear purpose for the miracles. And his disciples believed. Key point. We'll talk about this a little bit more. This marks the powerful start to the ministry of Jesus. Perhaps the full impact of this miracle is understood when connected to the events of the previous chapter. I want to back up for just a moment here as we kind of roll from one chapter to the next. Remember how the last chapter ended here? Remember, Jesus had called some to be his disciples, some who had become his apostles, and had said to them, "Follow me," remember? In chapter 1, verse 48, Nathanael said to him, that is, said to Jesus, "How do you know me?" And Jesus answered and said to him, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." And Jesus answered, verse 49, Nathanael answered and said to him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Remember, we'd already identified that these were some of the men who had been looking for the Messiah. They knew what the prophet said. And they were excited because they knew they had found somebody. Verse 50, Jesus answered and said to him, "Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater than these." Well, that was a notable miracle in itself. But, you know, only Nathanael understood, truly. Because Jesus said something to Nathanael where Nathanael knew that Jesus was special and had ability beyond just men. And Jesus says, "You will see greater than these." Jesus knew that there were some events that were to come. Verse 51, and Jesus said to him, "Most assuredly, I say to you, hereafter you will see heaven open and angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." Okay, with those things being said is what leads us into the story in John chapter 2, where in fact there is going to be a miracle that takes place. Well, let's talk for a few minutes about, thank you, Darrell, I appreciate that. I hope I didn't send you off to do that, and I don't even get to the map, but at least that's done. I think we will get to the map. Let's talk about the miracle here for a minute, the water turned to wine. I'm convinced that this is recorded for us so that we can see and understand the power of God. And there's some significance due to the fact that this is his first public miracle, even though he's demonstrated his power to some others, like Nathanael. "I saw you under the fig tree." But this is something that's going to become a little bit wider known, more widespread. And too often, though, the discussion just goes to, did Jesus make alcoholic wine? Well, we can't ignore that point. We're going to stop right here and kind of talk about this for a little bit. You know, though I'm going to tell you, I don't think that's even the point of the text. The point of the text is the miracle of Jesus. And yet, people, religious and non-religious, can bring up the point, well, even Jesus made wine. And they know that because that's an argument that so many make. But the point is the miracle of Jesus. And so we've got to talk about this and try to put some things. I want to talk about it within the context of this passage. There's a lot of things that can be said about alcoholic drink, and there's a lot of debate on this side, on that side. It's an issue right now that among brethren is becoming more and more heated, the idea of social drink, is it right or wrong? And, you know, I've really been working on that some lately, and some things I want to present on that in some time. That is not the purpose of this discussion. Well, I want to look at this in the context of John chapter 2, and what conclusions can we draw on this point? Did Jesus make alcoholic wine? On your outline, here are some key points, at least as I see, here are some key points to use in the discussion. Wine. And what does that infer? Well, it depends. It can really depend. The Greek word onios that is used here is a generic word referring to all kinds of wine in all stages, fermented, unfermented, intoxicating, and non-intoxicating. Now, I'll tell you, when you're talking with someone who wants to try to make an argument that it is right or it's okay, it's good for one who is a Christian to be able to drink alcoholic wine. Even Jesus made wine. One of the first things they say. Or in fact, even if you're in a little bit deeper conversation with someone, maybe who has a little bit of spiritual background, when they're stuck on making an argument on is it right or wrong to drink alcoholic beverages, their trump card, almost always, at least in my experience, has been, but Jesus made wine. As though that takes care of some things. That answers it. Well, when that happens, I realize, don't know. I mean, you really don't know what they're even saying. Because if this is the proof text that someone's going to try to use to justify alcoholic drink, I have no idea what they're talking about. Why would I say that? Why is this a strong argument or not a strong argument for drinking alcoholic beverages?
There's other things in the Bible about Noah. You know, you take Noah for instance. He got drunk and he caused a lot of problems.
There are a lot of passages that you can go to. I say a lot. There's not an incredible amount of passages about alcoholic drink, but there's other passages that you can go to that have some things to say about alcoholic drink. Yeah, for sure, we see the sin of drunkenness. But people say, oh, well, I'm not talking about getting drunk. I'm talking about just having an alcoholic drink. Jesus made wine. That justifies. Jesus made wine.
Paul told Timothy to take a little wine for his stomach.
Next argument. That's going to be the next argument that's going to come up, you know, that is justifying. And I agree that it justifies alcoholic drink for medicinal purposes. As far as that argument can go, as far as that justifies. But in this text, I mean, what can be said?
Well, I was answering previous
questions. Oh, go ahead.
But you were saying, what do you do when people ask that question? I think one of the things you can say is, well, you know, Jesus did a lot of things and taught a lot of things. Why don't we talk about some of those things as well?
True.
You know, people want to cite that example of Jesus Christ and follow that one, but they're not willing to follow the other examples he did. And that would be my story.
That's a good point. That's a good point, sure. What else?
Well, I mean, from my position, I've always taken it at face value, just like you take other scriptures. If God says he created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, I believe it. If Jesus made water into wine, mm-hmm. I believe it. Mm-hmm. If Jesus multiplied loaves and fishes and fed over 5,000, I believe it.
If you believe one, you've got to believe
it. You've got to believe it.
That's right.
And, you know, if you get down to how we're going to define wine, it's kind of an offshoot issue as to how much alcoholic content it had. Or
so it's bringing all other kinds of discussion.
It does. It brings other things in. But the main point, I think, for us or anybody else, it says, okay, if someone says that, trying to justify drinking mm-hmm. socially, you ask them, do you believe that? Do you believe Jesus? Do you believe that he mm-hmm. performed this miracle? And then if you agree with them, and we can agree together, mm-hmm. then you can springboard from that, like Rick
yeah,
said.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And say, well, do you believe him when he said that he that believeth in his
right.
baptized shall be saved?
I love that point.
Do you believe that as much as you believe that he
I'm going to tell you, I really hadn't thought of that so much. You know, I am really glad that you guys are bringing that up. Because it's a beautiful segue into some discussion on some other things. If you believe, okay, you believe Jesus made water into wine, and yes, for whatever their argument is, okay, then do you believe what Jesus said about salvation? I mean, you can take that and make a beautiful argument out of that. In discussions I've had with people on this passage, that would not be where they want to go. That's not what they're trying to justify. Let me get Dave here real quick.
You need to define what the new wine is, and you need to know what the motivation is.
There's an important point to be made about the word wine here. I mean, here again, I said, I really want to try to stay right here in the context of this passage. I know there's some other passages we can turn to. I understand that. This is the study of the Gospel of John. We're trying to stay in the context of this, not ignoring some other things, but just looking at this right here. I mean, the word wine of itself does not tell us fermented wine or unfermented wine. Because when you look at that Greek word that is used throughout the text, or a Hebrew equivalent, to this word. The word wine itself does not infer alcoholic or non-alcoholic. We cannot read this here that he made water to wine and assume that it's alcoholic. The word does not lead us to that conclusion. Now, you know, some people, I mean, they just, well, of course it had to have been alcoholic wine because, you know, the water was not good and pure back then, and they had to make wine because that was the only safe thing they could drink, and you know, there's all of these kinds of arguments that go on. Well, wait a minute. All water was not bad. We've made an assumption that all water was bad and had to be purified. That's not true. So that argument won't work. That's not valid. Wine is used in Scripture sometimes to refer to nothing more than grape juice. Oh, but this was good. Some grape juice is good. Some is not so good.
Especially when you compare it to water.
Exactly right. You know, and some is sweeter than others. And so, again, there's no argument there. It says wine. And in Scripture, the Greek word that is used there can refer to all kinds of wine. In all stages, new wine, old wine, fermented wine, unfermented. Well, if it's old wine, it has to be fermented. No, it does not. When you really study that, is it more likely to be fermented if it's old? Yes. Does it have to be fermented if it's old? No. Well, they could not preserve it. Yes, they could. If you go down that road right there, you will find out that you cannot justify your arguments on that. They could purify to a certain point first. Not purify. They could preserve to a certain point and for a certain time. Unfermented wine. They could do that. And they could preserve grapes to make wine later that was unfermented wine. Documented. I didn't know that. I didn't think so. Been doing some study on that. Documented. So the arguments that some have made that if it's wine, it could only be grape juice for a few days and of necessity it would become fermented, that could be the case. But it is not necessarily the case. That is not a valid argument to make. And so, you know, some of the studying I've done on that here in you know, recent months, you know, a little bit here and a little bit there, has kind of changed my thoughts on the idea of fermented wine and unfermented wine. How long could it be unfermented before it becomes alcoholic? And some things such as that. They had ways of preserving that I didn't fully realize. Okay, now there were several hands. You have to show me again. Rick, you had a comment again?
Well, there's a lot of things that can be said. And one is, even if Jesus did make alcoholic wine, if there was some alcoholic content, that doesn't condone the use of it. It does not condone drunkenness, which is condemned in the Bible.
Right.
It does not, you know, it violates what Paul said about Christians being sober-minded, not saying that
right.
That's alcohol.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That would prohibit any abuse of any kind of alcoholic beverage, that even if Jesus did make some wine with alcoholic content, you know.
I understand your point. I do. James and then Brent.
I noticed that in the Bible where it's talking about old cloth, new cloth on the old cloth,
mm-hmm.
it talks about new wine in the old wineskin.
Mm-hmm.
And then carry it through the desert. As it gets older, it begins to ferment.
It's going to bust the bag.
Mm-hmm. So if you can think along that idea, the new wine would be closer to grape juice,
mm-hmm.
whereas older wine would be closer to the more fermented.
Could very well be true. That's right. Not seasoned. That's right. Brent? To the brim. Mm-hmm.
He said, "Sir."
Mm-hmm.
And that was the miracle. That was the miracle.
And again, I think, Brent, I think, again, that's the point of emphasis here, is that for there to have been wine, it was not something that had been made overnight, you know, for it to be good wine, fermented or unfermented. There was a process that had to be done. And the process in this case was Jesus miraculously making it good wine, filled to the brim from the beginning. And so those who were there serving, you know, and to think about this, who knew about the miracle? Just be kind of thinking that through some, you know, as we discuss this some. Who knew about the miracle? I mean, Jesus had filled the water, had them fill the water pots all the way up to the top, and now all of a sudden it is good wine. Just think on that for a second. Go ahead then Emily. Brent, do you have another comment?
Well, I'll have a comment about something else.
Okay, Emily. Why is that missed almost always when somebody wants to discuss this passage?
Because everybody wants to discuss wine.
That's right. That's right.
And the argument is not here.
It's not here. An agenda sometimes gets us to the point where we miss the point. We do. I hear it than you.
I can hear the argument for those who in favor of the alcoholic wine saying, well, he says right here that they start with the good stuff and once they've gotten drunk freely, you know, that's not what
okay.
It says. I don't know about you, but I can sit down and cut into a beautiful piece of steak that just tastes absolutely fantastic. But by the end of the meal, it doesn't taste so good anymore. Uh-huh. If you have good stuff, you don't appreciate it as much. So, you know, if something a little less quality comes along, you don't even realize it because it's not talking about the fact that there's too drunk to understand it or to realize it.
Okay. That's another powerful point we need to talk about for a minute. I'm glad you bring this up now.
Wouldn't you say most of the time when somebody has this issue, it's a matter of carnality and worrying about the flesh than it is more spiritual things?
The point of the text gets lost because of an agenda. So often is what happens there. And I don't want to paint with such a broad brush that we paint everybody under the bus kind of a thing. But I'm just saying from different times, different discussions, you know, when somebody brings this up, but even Jesus made wine, they're on an agenda of justifying alcoholic drink. Now, the whole purpose of this discussion, you know, is not to come to a point of just a class on social drinking. We've got that coming up. I'm trying to say just here in this text, and let's understand the power and the purpose of the text. And the arguments that some use or misuse on this. You know, Neil, I want to go back to your point here about the well drunk. And the next argument I've heard, perhaps you've heard some others, they say, well, look, they were already drunk. Or they've already, you know, drank enough that when the new wine was served, you know, it had to have been really strong wine for them to know it was new wine. They're trying to make the point or argument that they're already feeling the effects of the alcohol they've been drinking. How do you deal with that? I mean, when you look at the word that's used there, look at your outline, Neil.
They're also trying to imply that what makes the wine good is the alcohol.
Oh, yeah, another good point. Yeah, hey, let's touch on that for a second. Another thing that you read about, if you do some honest investigation about the use of the word wine, what makes good wine or not so good wine in ancient times, it's so often not the alcohol content. It's just the flavor of the wine, the taste of the wine. Because often when they were drinking wine, as in grape juice, often it was watered down. You had to make that go a ways. Of course, the more you water it down, more likely the less flavor there is and the less sweetness that there may be. Often, as far as it being good wine or not, is not necessarily talking about if it's alcoholic or not. That's another point. Someone, see, it was good wine. It had to have been alcoholic. No, that is historically, That is not accurate. I mean, I understand what they're trying to do, and I understand their argument, but it's not accurate when you really go back and you read some ancient writings on things like that. This phrase, well drunk, and we'll talk about this in a minute. I mean, look at your outline. You got a point here. Does it mean that they were already intoxicated? Okay, if it means that they were already intoxicated, I'm really having a struggle here. I'm having a problem with the fact that Jesus is making them more wine to get them more drunk. I mean, can we even try to draw a conclusion that that's what's really happening here? I mean, when Scripture from the Old Testament even, you know, talks about the foolishness of strong drink and the sin of being drunk, Jesus, the Son of God, the Lamb of God, as he's been introduced, has now fulfilled the desire of carnal man to help them get more drunk? I mean, from the text, how in the world could we draw that conclusion? Harry.
I got two things to say about that. The well drunk, I read that as being like a horse is well watered. Now, I might imply that they were intoxicated because they drank, you know, the well watered with a lot of wine. The second thing I have about it is in verse 10. It says, when the guests have well drunk, then they fear, you have kept a good wine in and out. That seems to be sort of like Jesus set it up so he can make the point himself that you need to keep sober so that you can enjoy the sweeter wine.
They could know the difference, that this was sweeter wine or better tasting in that way. Your points are good, well taken. The phrase here, well drunk, I mean, when we see the word drunk, it's easy for us to assume. You know, in the way that the term is used in our vernacular, we're talking about somebody who has just, you know, has had too much to drink and has lost their senses, kind of a thing. Inebriated is what we think. Not always the way the word is used in the text or in scriptures. You know, the word drunk, the Greek word that is translated here, drunk, can mean intoxicated or inebriated. Indeed, it can mean that. We find it used that way in Scripture. It can also mean, Harry, just as you said, it can also mean satiated or full. I am well drunk. I've had all I can eat. I've had all I can drink. I am filled.
That's...
Well, yeah, I see how it could be used that way. I don't think that's the way it's used here. I think it's more of the term that they were filled that way. You know, they had what they wanted, but here now is even greater wine, better wine that has been provided. You know, we discussed this more than I actually thought we would, but you've heard some of the same arguments I have. Some of us have made these arguments before about what does this mean. You know, even Jesus made wine. And now, the more I look at the text, the more I can see and understand that, number one, we're missing the point of the text. It's about the miracle of Jesus. That's what the text is about. I am not seeing from the text how we can infer in any way that Jesus made alcoholic wine. Did he make alcoholic wine? I cannot tell you that he did not. The only way that we can draw a conclusion of whether speaking of alcoholic wine or non-alcoholic wine is by the context. And the context does not tell us. The fact that the context does not lead us to a conclusion that he did make alcoholic wine is interesting to me. And tends to lead me to think that he did not. But I can't prove that because the text does not tell us. And so we have to be careful on our arguments on that. But what we can determine from the text is that Jesus made wine and it was really good. And even though everyone was already well drunk, they were filled, they were satiated. they knew that what they were drinking now was different than what they were drinking before. And they knew that the wine pots had all been emptied, but now they were all filled to the brim, and that it was good wine. And they would see in time where that, understand in time where that came from. And the purpose of the miracle, verse 11, this beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. When we discuss, and when people want to discuss Jesus making water to wine, and discuss all of the things and the elements that we've been talking about here, and we miss the conclusion of that in verse 11, that it was a miracle, that it manifested his glory, it made Jesus shine in his glory, and we miss that, and that his disciples believe, we have missed the whole purpose of the text. Thoughts or comments? Daryl?
I've just kind of been thinking that it's interesting that its first miracle, it's way up here in some small place in Galilee, and it wasn't performed in front of some important people of the day. It was performed in front of some servants in maybe a back room. And it kind of reminds me of the way, you know, the star appears, and it's proclaimed to the shepherds when he was born, and not to the royalty of the day. So it's just an interesting.
Why do you think? Because look, there was some effort to not make this a big scene. Why? I mean, this is the first public miracle of Jesus.
Jesus says himself, "My hour is not
come." What's that about?
It's not time for him to reveal himself to the public.
So there is going to be a time where all will know him. And it's interesting, from this point on now, things start to change. But why did he say that? Yeah, Mac?
I think included in all this is we have evidence of a Jewish brother, a Jewish son, being obedient to his Jewish mother.
Here's another interesting element, you know, to this. It was the mother of Jesus who said, "Do something." I mean, what's going on? I mean, did Jesus not know? I mean, did Jesus not realize there was no wine? Did Jesus not realize he should do something? Why did Mary say something? Why did Jesus respond the way he did? You know, in some ways, it sounds a little bit curt. His response, that is not the bell. I'm so sleepy, I'm hearing a bell ring in my mind. Okay. The response of Jesus here, let's see, when Mary said, "Say they ran out of the wine," and the mother of Jesus said to him, verse 3, "They have no wine." And Jesus says, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." Doesn't that sound a little bit harsh? What do you think about that, Brent?
Well, I was thinking about that he didn't call her mother, he called her woman.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think the point that he made about, well, I'm not, it's not time for me to manifest my glory or whatever, that my hour has not come. We see later, he will actually say that again, and then later he will say, "My hour has come."
Mm-hmm.
Or the writer will say, "His hour has come." Mm-hmm. Beginning in a way of a ministry
It's interesting that Jesus did what she wanted him to do. You know, even though she responded back to him, it wasn't a done issue. He did that. And the idea that my hour is not yet come. I wanted to look at this, but I don't have time today. I think it's 6 times in the book of John where he'll say that phrase. My hour is not yet come. And of course, when we see in those cases, for sure, it's talking about the fact that it's not time yet for me to be fully revealed, you know, to all. Rick.
Mm-hmm. It's really what I think he's, this is, you know, we're not the host here kind of thing.
I think that's right. In fact, some things I've read about that, you know, basically said Jesus really was not being curt to his mother, particularly when you read it in the Greek and the English, it sounds a little bit, from the way we would say things, that sounds a little bit, that's not really the point of what Jesus was saying. I think it's like what you're saying here. It's like, well, what real concern is that this is not our party, you know? It's like this is not our issue. It's this, you know, kind of a thing. I think it's more of the idea of that. But
then her response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost as though she is anticipating that he is going to do something and he is going to be revealed in this. And he is revealed in this to some. You know, to some. Of course, now, today, to us, he's revealed to all, isn't he? Ken.
Term that he used, woman, it wasn't a derogatory. That's the same word that he used when he was on the cross.
That's true. That's right. I thought that's where Brent was going with that. In fact, you're right. You know, that he'd use the same term. All right, our time here is gone, basically.